So what about using NFP in some atypical situations? A common question is, what about after the pill? There's a couple of studies that give us some information on that. One was a study by Narcella and company. It was a retrospective analysis of 70 women who had stopped oral contraceptives versus 70 HMATs, non-oral contraceptive users, and it looked at the characteristics of their cycles, which are here. Lower mucus quality scores. These were all Creighton trainees here, too. This is Creighton model stuff. They had a later estimated day of ovulation on the pill, coming off the pill, than non-pill. Lighter menses. The biomarkers were impacted for the first 6 months or so, but their ability and their confidence with the Creighton method was no different between the two groups, so regardless of what's going on in the school. And the changes here are not atypical in what one would expect. The German group, again, did another larger study, took 175 women who were discontinuing the pill and learning symptothermal for the first time, compared that to 284 women who weren't on the pill but learning symptothermal, and looked at what the differences in the cycle were there, and this is just what they were on when they stopped. A pretty typical market share for the different kinds of formulations of oral contraceptives. The first post-pill cycle, half the cycles first post-pill were normal, half were abnormal, and the major abnormality was a shortened luteal phase, okay, less than 10 days long. The other ones, they did, some of them didn't ovulate, about 10%, against about a 3% anovulatory rate in the normal population. And then some women had a very long cycle, but with a normal luteal phase. So then, like Narsala found, longer cycles.
Nasrallah. Just say Claudia.
More anovulatory cycles, a delayed mucus peak day, and a delayed first day of temperature rise, which always correlates pretty closely with the peak day. But regardless of whether they were on the pill or not on the pill, they could identify that mucus peak in the first couple cycles at equal rates. And when they did a secondary analysis for unintended pregnancy rates, they got comparative numbers there. So both of us figure this is pretty good data. We'll give it a B+. not unexpected. And in fact, in light of today's very light formulations of oral contraceptives, I mean, we see most of our post-pill cycles look pretty normal pretty quickly. And if anything, things are just delayed a little bit.
That's actually right.
And then they quickly move back to where you'd expect them to be normal. So not a big surprise.
Do I have a little?
Yeah.
So what about in women with really short and really long cycles? What do we know about that? Well, all of the major efficacy trials to look at effectiveness for avoiding pregnancy excluded women with consistent cycles below 22, 21 days and women with extremely long cycles. So there isn't any data. Okay, but the other question from a reality standpoint is, how many women really do have consistently very short or very long cycles? And the answer is not a lot. This is taken from a gynecological endocrinology textbook. And the blue line here is the average cycle length by age of women. Okay, and this is kind of a compilation of a few cohort studies that have done. The purple lines show you the 95% confidence interval. So that's where 95% of the population falls within that range. What you can see is, first, there's very few short cycles in the population. And long cycles happen in teenagers and perimenopausal women. So anytime I'm in front of physicians or a medical audience, I try and emphasize that cycle irregularity in women under 20 years old is normal and typical. And we don't need to prescribe for irregular cycles. That's normal. But we have conditioned ourselves, particularly here in the States, that I'm supposed to have a 28-day cycle, and if it's 29 days, I gotta go get it fixed. Okay? But that's normal. It's to be expected. So, how many people do really have? A big Danish study looked at that. Less than 0.5% of women in this cohort had cycle lengths that were usually less than 21 days. About 1% had longer cycles. Okay, so tiny populations consistently. However, the occasional short or long cycle is not uncommon. Okay, about 20% of women will have a short cycle, so you've got to be aware of that if you're expecting your method to be effective. And about a third, about 30% of women will occasionally have that long cycle. Okay? So cycle variability happens in the population. It just doesn't happen all the time in all the same women. A U.S. sample, this is again the Marquette group. They found that, again, most of the cycles were between 22 and 36 days long. They were actually looking at the, where did the fertile window fall? Between days 4 and 23 was where most of the 6 days of the fertile window fell. Okay. But 25% of the cycles, only 25% of the cycles, did that 6 day window fall between days 10 and 17, which is consistent with what we found with many of the calendar methods, that long delayed cycles or short cycles were a problem with calendar based methods. And that 42% of women at some point in time had cycle variability greater than 7 days. It does happen, it's not unexpected. So there's little hard evidence for effectiveness in these long or short cycles. It's likely that the long cycles are more common. The underlying biology would say if you've got very short cycles persistently, your ability to conceive and carry a pregnancy is probably limited. Physiologically, there just isn't enough time for the endometrium to develop to receive an implanted egg and then maintain it through time. Doesn't mean it can't happen. Anything can happen, right?
That's right.
You had Mary. Birth. So evidence breaks then. So preventing pregnancy in women with consistently short cycles, just no data. Now, whether or not that's clinically important for the 0.5% of the population, if you were one of those women, it may be important, but in the general standpoint. In consistently long cycles, Richard gives it a C. I still say whether it really just isn't any evidence. Preventing pregnancy with the occasional short and long cycle. Again, we assume that there are those occurrences that happened within the trials that have been conducted, but we haven't seen the cohorts pulled out in a way to analyze it, so we're scoring it mixed, right? There's some evidence that it's there. Okay.
I'm willing to drop my grade down to an F.
That's our hour mark.
Okay. I'll just go through this real quick. This section here, and then we can see if there's questions, and then if there's no question, we can do the rest. There's a lot of questions regarding the differences between contraception and natural family planning, and also with divorce rates, and because we're talking about divorce in this marriage conference here, that's probably pretty important. There was actually one study that looked at a comparison that, I believe it was population, but I should have read this a little bit closer before I came here. It's a German study by Odins, looked at 522 people on the pill, 136 were sterilized, and 76 people on natural family planning. And the final conclusion of this paper was that they were pretty satisfied. There was good satisfaction with sterility, then the pill, and natural family planning. They also looked at condoms, where there was a lower level with NFP. But if you look at the data, and I put it in red, first of all, concerned pregnancy. Well, people are a lot of anxiety about being on NFP and with unintended pregnancy. But more irritable, it's lower. More depressed, it's lower. More pleasurable, it is equivalent, probably. And sex drive increase is, it's pretty high. So I look at this, yes, you're anxious about pregnancy, but you're less irritable, depressed, you have more pleasure and a higher sex drive. That sounds pretty good to me. But that's some evidence here. I actually did two studies with earlier studies where we compared natural family planning with contraception. Was in Lineker Quarterly and International Review. Now, these are not high levels. We did matching, but we also took it from a same practice from OBGYN that were using equivalent type of couples in that they were Catholic, well-educated, and so forth. So they were pretty close. And we gave them a spiritual well-being index, self-esteem index, sexual intimacy, and essentially showed that people using natural family planning had higher levels of spiritual well-being, religious well-being, sexual intimacy, and so forth. Is this a great study? I would not rate it, but there's some comparisons. I did an anthropological look at natural family planning with Father William Kurtz, who is a theologian at Marquette University, and actually has some good comparisons, and I probably could come up with some evidence for each of these looking at comparisons in regards to contraception and NFP, as fertility with contraception is a medical problem, it's a natural process with NFP, medical side effects, no medical side effects, mask medical problems, health-identified medical problems. Right now, there's a big movement Actually, there is consensus date from OBGYN and pediatrics that the menstrual cycle is a vital sign for women's health. So just from that standpoint, you have some at least consensus evidence. The one easy to use, I have sometimes it's challenging to use for NFP. In regards to communication, women's respective role model, we do have some descriptive evidence for this, and then spiritual differences, which I would like to go. So sometimes either the August or November issue has a whole thing on NFP and spirituality that I did. But this question about NFP and divorce. Well, Mercedes Wilson did a study. She worked with, from John Hopkins, a scientist from John Hopkins, and she presented this at the Catholic Social Scientists organization and got into the journal. Now, this journal is not, it might be peer-reviewed, but it's not medical index or anything, so it's kind of lost, and it's really not high level. And she looked, she did a survey, she sent out a survey probably to the Families of America users with 505 Catholic women, and she pulled out a subset of 21 to 44, and then looked at the national survey for family growth, which is done every 5-6 years, which is a population-based through the University of Michigan. There's a big difference when you can take a population and randomly select. When you have a population-based, you can make comments about all reproductive age women in the United States. When you do a survey of select women, you cannot do that. That's generalizability versus it just applies to the women that you survey. So she found in her survey with these women, these Catholic women who are using Families of America, 3% divorce rate versus 15% with the Catholic women in the National Survey of Family Growth. And they weren't using natural family planning. But all I can say about this, it's low level in regard to where it's published and things like that. It was not spelled out in regard to methodology. Is really looking at apples and oranges and saying, yes, there's differences. Now, I have access to a number of publications with the data through the National Survey of Family Growth. There's 1,502 Catholic women in the 2010 survey, and you can get this as for scientists to utilize and pull it down. What I looked at is there's 105 ever use of natural family planning. So I looked at these 105 users of NFP and looked at whether they were divorced or not divorced. I also looked at the pill, sterilization, rhythm, NFP, and church attendance. I did what is called odds ratio, the likelihood of having divorce versus not. And so the big predictor is sterilization. It's about almost 2.5 times more likely if you have been sterilized that you're going to be divorced compared to those who have never been sterilized. NFP, it's about a 53% less likely if you ever use NFP to be divorced. And church attendance, and that's at least going to church once a week or more, it's about 33% less likely among these 1,502 Catholic women. The actual rate was 9.5% ever use of NFP versus never use of 18.3. Now, just whether you use the NFP or church attendance doesn't tell you whether they are the contributors things. We have in statistics and biostatistics something called logistic regression, where you look at a whole bunch of predictors and to see whether somebody's divorced or not. And so I'm trying to develop some of these models, and I looked at sterilized or not, abortion or not, multiple sex partners throughout their life, cohabitation, NFP use, importance of religion, and church attendance, and look at the dependent variable of divorce or not. That R square at 45%, I can build a model where I can explain 45% of the variability of being divorced or not based upon these predictor variables. The biggest predictor is sterilization by far. That doesn't mean that sterilization causes divorce, but it's the biggest predictor of it. When I look at NFP and church attendance, it only comes out to be about 2% of the predictability. But these are all just Catholic women. You know, that data set has about 10, 11,000 women between the ages of 15 and 44. I like to look at the broader group of women and have more power to look at some of these models of some of these variables as they contribute to divorce or not. So, our grades, F and F. And it doesn't stand for fairing. I just want to give an antidote to something that two of the that Mike gave. It's sort of maybe self-praise or something like that. I also, besides having PhD students, I have three PhD students and a DNP student that hopefully will be carrying on research. I'm looking at, hopefully I can do maybe about 4 or 5 years yet. I'm now a professor emeritus. So, you know, I'm breastfeeding study with Mary. She and Mew are looking at subfertility. Dana Rodriguez is looking at adolescence and chastity training and that. But every year I have one or two medical residents going and working with me because I'm an active researcher. That Nocerella, Claudia Nocerella, was a resident at Mayo Clinic, and she came to Marquette to do a residency, month residency with me research, and we did that study. Dr. Thomas Bouchard was from the University of Calgary, and we did the breastfeeding study, and I have done BMI studies and different studies in that. So all I'm saying is that being active in research, being able to do that, takes a lot of work and a lot of time, but it is a gift for the church in regards to being able to train people to do this important work. So I think we have
One more section, but I think we'll stop it right here, actually.
Yeah,
sure,
I think we
have questions.
Yeah.
So.
I have a quick question. On that part about sterilization, do they take into account that the partner had a vasectomy?
I believe it was just a woman. I would have to look at it because there is, you know, they have about two or three questions in that data set about sterilization. I know there is men sterilized and women sterilized. I might have to pull in that men sterilized too. That's a good thought. They'll probably have to put that into the model. But more women are sterilized than men, but there still is a factor.
And this question is both to both of you. So when an NFP teacher is in the classroom, or when an NFP educator is in the diocese is trying to summarize what we do know, it's still fair to say that there's a likelihood that natural family planning use contributes to a stable marriage, correct? Can you say that?
I wouldn't say it that way, actually.
How would you say it?
I'd say couples who can... couples who adopt and appreciate and use NFP usually have the skill set they need to keep their marriage healthy and flourishing and avoid divorce. Because
okay.
It's like if I gave this table bourbon water and
like
ice,
example.
I gave that table vodka water and ice, and I gave that table whiskey water and ice, and they all got drunk, I'd conclude that ice is... Sorry, you don't have to move tables then. But from that, we might conclude that ice causes people to get drunk. Okay?
Yeah.
So there's causality and association, and we have to be careful. And frankly, in the NFP community, we've been a little too aggressive on asserting that NFP causes us to not have divorce, which I think we have to be very careful about. That's not to say that people who use NFP don't get divorced at lower rates.
But the kind of person who will be less likely to get divorced is the kind of person who's going to take the time and self-discipline to use NFP.
And I think actually the use of NFP is a daily reminder to keep those skills going.